Hi, welcome to this week's program. You know, sometimes you hear people complain that they don't make enough money, and it's justified in a sense that what they make might not be enough to cover the cost of a decent lifestyle. I read some time ago that it's not that things are too expensive, it's that you don't make enough money. Now, that sounds like a silly statement at first, but what I like about it is that it puts the onus of the dilemma on the person, not the situation. I truly believe that in this day and age, if you want to make more money or do something that you're passionate about, there are almost infinite varieties of opportunities to take advantage of. Now, this all occurred to me as I read a recent article in Forbes penned by Elaine Pofelt, who recounts the amazing success story of Sean Kelly. Sean founded his own million-dollar business by following some very simple ideas and using a little creativity to execute them. His story is just one of many among a growing trend of single-person business people that have made millions. According to the latest census data as of 2017, there were more than 35,000 such one-person companies generating yearly revenues between $1 and $2.5 million. Most of these success stories have been fueled in part by the explosion in social media marketing. Now here's Sean's story. Sean hit one of life's many speed bumps during his freshman year of college when he didn't pass a math course required for his major. So he decided to take some time off from school, but before leaving, he got an idea and started his own business from the dorm room. Now, the inspiration for his business was simply the fact that he saw many fellow students wearing jersey shirts. He noticed that many of the shirts promoted professional sports teams, but he realized he didn't have the money to pay the huge licensing fees necessary to produce them, so he came up with the idea of making jerseys that promoted rappers, hip-hop artists, and also vintage, retro-type television shows. So, rather than pay licensing fees, he contacted the artists he wanted to feature on his shirts and negotiated revenue-sharing deals with them. In other words, they would make money every time he sold a shirt. That's a simple example of creative thinking to work around an obstacle. Now, to get the business going, he invested $1,000 and hired a graphic designer, and then through some clever research, found an inexpensive manufacturer in Pakistan through the e-commerce site Alibaba. He then set up a simple online store with a site called Shopify. Then Sean used some marketing creativity to get the word out. One step was asking musicians he featured on his shirts to post his jerseys on their Instagram page. Now, some of the musicians wanted to be paid to post, and some did it for free, but it was through methods like that that enabled him to build an Instagram following of more than 2 million people. He even sold some shirts directly to the artists themselves for wholesale, which enabled the artist to sell the shirts as merch, I guess at appearances or concerts. Another creative marketing tactic, one which he used to build his brand name, was doing giveaways. He even participated in a giveaway program run by the Kardashians. He notes that while doing that cost $15,000, by doing so, he gained approximately 100,000 followers virtually overnight. Also, as Facebook has gained incredible marketing power now with billions of followers, he bought paid advertising on Facebook to build his business. And now he's currently expanding his social media advertising to the relatively new social site TikTok. So it all worked out pretty well for a kid who was looking to leave school after failing a math exam. Sean reports that he achieved nearly $250,000 in revenues during his first year in business in 2016. He nearly doubled that the next year and achieved $1.2 million in sales for year three. But he's being smart about the money too. He keeps his business lean, paying himself a reasonable $50,000 annual salary, and using the excess profits to reinvest and continue to grow. He's a smart young man. Now Sean speaks to other budding entrepreneurs sharing his success story. One unexpected bonus? The amount of money he charges to his credit card for ads generates enough airline reward miles to enable him to pretty much travel for free whenever and wherever he wants to go. Now, Jersey Champs is still just a one-man business that he operates from home on his laptop. I don't even have an office, he says. And as far as continuing to pursue a degree in business, well, for the moment, he's discovered that he likes working and making money a lot more than going to class. So the bottom line for all of us is there is plenty of opportunity for anyone to exploit. It just takes some clear thinking, a website, a phone, a little startup money, and a very strong desire to get ahead in the world and get what you want. Because as I said before, it's not that things are expensive, it's just that you don't make enough money. Once again, I want to give my thanks to Elaine Pofeld for her article. And if you want to read about other similar entrepreneur success stories, Elaine has written a book on the subject, The $1 Million One Person Business. As you know, my mission is always to educate my listeners, and I remind you week after week, segment after segment, that we love your questions, because we do. These are complicated times, which makes for complicated topics, and I'm always here to answer them. So if you have questions about your portfolio, your kids' kids, your retirement, your 401k, how to take better care of your family, anything financial on your mind, I'm here with 35 years of experience, and I'd love to help you in any way I can. So go to stevepomerantz.com, go to the contact section, and let me know how we can help. That's stevepomerantz.com, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z, no T, stevepomerantz.com, and contact us one more time, stevepomerantz.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. For anyone who has ever owned a business or is operating a business right now, my next guest makes a startling pronouncement. And that pronouncement is, marketing as we know it is dead. And if you're going to survive and thrive in today's business world, you'll have to figure out how this new world operates. Also, as a consumer, you're going to want to know how companies are trying to manipulate you to get you to buy their stuff. My guest is Carlos Gil. He is an international keynote speaker, award-winning digital storyteller, and has been featured in Harvard Business Review, Entrepreneur Magazine, and has led social media strategies for LinkedIn, Winn-Dixie, and other Fortune 500 companies. His book is The End of Marketing: Humanizing Your Brand in the Age of Social Media and AI, and he explains it all. Welcome to the program, Carlos.
Steve, it's great to be here with you. Thank you for having me.
You know, marketing may be dead, but consumerism will always be here. After all, we're humans and we love to buy things, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the path to purchase is not linear anymore. And, you know, we are in this era where people are influenced by friends. People are influenced by celebrities that they're seeing on TV and traditional mass media. And then there's social media. So then the marketing really focuses a lot on building an audience, building advocacy, listening to what's being said on social media, because let's, you know, realize the obvious. We live in two parallel universes. There's the real world and then there's the online world. And there's so much power by tapping into the online world that can be discovered. But the reality, Steve, is that we live in this noisy, giant digital ocean. And what the end of marketing really tries to solve for any small business owner all the way on up to a enterprise marketer is that relationships are paramount to everything that we do.
Let's compare this to the typical historical way marketing was done. Give us a brief history. As I, you know, say to people, I know about marketing in Madison Avenue because I watched Mad Men, so I'm an expert now. All the drinking in the afternoon and all that. But seriously, what was marketing like before social media came on the scene?
Well, you know, in full disclosure, I'm 36 years old, so my memories of marketing pre-internet is quite limited. But what I will say is, you know, growing up as a kid in South Florida, commercials is everything, right? So you see a commercial on TV for a pair of Air Jordans, and then the perception is, well, I can jump higher, I can play better basketball, you know, because I'm wearing Michael Jordan shoes. Same thing, you drink Gatorade. You know, all of a sudden, as a kid, you feel that you are invincible in the football field or on the basketball court. So, you know, marketing back then was very much driven by making people the faces of your brand, which is what I try to communicate through the end of marketing. It's not really changed much, except the medium is what's changed and the players have changed. The reality is that today you can become influential by just using a cell phone and a social media account, post the right mix of content and build a following. And then the next thing you know, people are trusting your word over a brand. And you see, it's interesting to point out that people today, everyday consumers, actually have the same access to marketing than companies, million and billion dollar companies. Like, granted, your average consumer doesn't have the bandwidth or the budget to put up a billboard on the side of I-95. But again, the rules of engagement have changed. People trust people. People buy from people. Logos are really losing their luster in the online world, because what people perceive logos as is brands and services and products. And I think people are learning how to tune out brands on social media and the internet, no different than they've learned how to tune them out on the radio or when they see a billboard.
You know, this is vitally important, because I think everyone starts off with the original thinking that, you know, the first thing you want to do is get a logo. You want to build your brand, whether it's your personal brand or a company brand. The brand was most important. And from what you're saying, it sounds to me like that has dissipated to a great degree, and a logo, a brand are less important. So what has been substituted for us? Tell us again.
You know, I'm glad that you brought that up, because most individuals, when they go into business, they spend a lot of money on having a professional logo designed and a branding kit and messaging, a website, and all these different elements. What's really important, first and foremost, is the ethos of your business. So that's your story. Why are you in business? First and foremost, who is it that you're trying to serve? Mm-hmm. And how can you get in front of them? People are less inclined to do business with you because you have a nice looking website, and they're more inclined to do business with you because you're meeting their needs and you're getting to them before your competition is.
Yeah. So the idea of having, you know, kind of a killer website, you know, for instance, I have a band. Mm-hmm. I'm a musician, I have a band, and I put up a great website. Of course, nobody's really going to the website, I noticed, too much. We're reaching out on Facebook and so on, and we're starting to gather some followers, but I don't actually think we're doing it correctly, because we're just kind of, we're putting up videos, but I'm not personally interacting with the people who are signing up. You know, you have a story in your book where you worked for a company and they had like 2 million visitors to their website, but a lot of that was fake. And you suggested to them that they go down and they just find 30 of those 2 million who were really advocates of the company. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm so glad that you brought up that example, Steve. Many times when I'm working with clients of my agency or when I'm consulting, I'm speaking to, you know, an older audience that's not as savvy when it comes to social media. So their perception is that you need to have the most likes, the most followers, the most impressions. And what I try to educate them on is, you know, first of all, likes and followers do nothing for your brand if you're not converting those likes and followers into advocates. I would rather have 10 people that consistently advocate for my company online every single time I post, as opposed to having thousands of followers which do nothing. So it's really getting executives to understand that you can't automate or really scale advocacy. What advocacy really means is you're creating loyalty within your customer base. And that starts with, first of all, using social media to truly listen to who is speaking about your brand. Meaning, if I go to, let's say, Nordstrom's and I buy a pair of Cole Haan shoes, and I'm checking in on social media that I'm at Nordstrom's, well, heck, Nordstrom's social media team somewhere in the world should be monitoring to see that Carlos Gil went into Nordstrom's and actually gave them a shout out, gave them a plug. That's free marketing.
Right.
That's what you want as a brand. But what happens, Steve, is 99% of brands are making marketing about them and not their customer. And what they're doing is they're pushing out content and expecting people to see it versus actually going out and looking for the content that's already being posted about them.
Hmm. Where is this posting being done of late?
Well, you know, you have platforms like Instagram that are extremely popular right now. Instagram is one of the most utilized social networks. And I'll give you an example. I was writing a proposal for a client recently, and I went onto Instagram and saw that this client had 24,000 mentions of their brand in the last year alone on Instagram. And they're actually a retail store.
Sounds great.
So I went back to the CMO and said, hey, look, you have 24,000 pieces of content promoting your company that you've never engaged with, that no one at your company has ever touched. No one's ever engaged. And the opportunity that lies is for your competition to swoop in and engage every single one of these customers. So I refer to social media throughout the book as the wild, wild west, because it is. There's no rules. There's no governing body at all that says that you cannot go out and engage with anyone. In fact, you can. And I bring light to the fact that when I worked at Winn-Dixie, being a supermarket chain, as a head of social media, I was constantly monitoring who was talking about Publix, who was talking negatively about Publix. And I would go to my chief marketing officer back then and say, hey, look, we have real people that exist that are talking about our competition in a negative way. That's an opportunity for us to engage. And back then in 2012, 2013 era, social media was still so new from a brand standpoint that, you know, the CMO basically would say, Carlos, we don't want to poke the bear. Go back and do your job and just focus on our customers. That's such a bad mentality, because we are getting ready to enter an era, Steve, where automation and AI, otherwise known as artificial intelligence and bots, are getting ready to really disrupt how marketing is done. And it's going to be less human. It's going to be less personable. And what I reference in the book throughout it is that we need to go back to the basics, which is building relationships and truly humanize your brand through people first, not products or services.
All right. So I get your concept here. And, you know, we're speaking, of course, in generalities, you know, the need to kind of get down to the level of the user and to benefit from their advocacy. You gave some examples in the book. Let's use Coke for an example. Coke, instead of being a company, you say they'll need to be a person consumers can relate to. Nike will have to be a team of athletes that people can aspire to. Whole Foods will need to be a series of people who teach me how to eat. And the local gym will need people to teach me how to work out. See, I'm trying to kind of dive down to the level of where the rubber meets the road, so to speak. I want you to help me understand this for my small business, let's say, what I need to do when I see someone advocating, mentioning my product. What do I need to do next? And who do I need to be to them?
So what you need to do is you need to find first, who are your customers and where do they live? So like in your case, you have a band, and I'm sure you want to get more people to come out and see you perform.
Yes, locally. That's right. Just locally.
Right. So maybe what you do is the next time that you have a booking for a show, what you do is you go on Instagram and see who are the people that are checking in at this venue and already posting content over, say, the last 3 months, and you personally reach out to them and you send them a message and you invite them to come see you perform.
Okay.
That's what I'm getting to. You have to get down to the nitty gritty of making people the face of your brand and have more conversations than just relying on posting content.
Okay. So that's pretty easy for me to do. It's a small following. Yet if I'm going to be a business with any decent scale and there's 24,000 people that are doing something, how do you do that? It seems quite intense and exhausting.
That's the thing, right? If you have a big business where you have resources already, why not just use those resources in an intelligent fashion? Like, I've worked on the inside of corporate America, Steve. I know what it's like to go into an hour meeting just to consume 5 minutes worth of content where everyone's just giving updates. Like, it's working smarter, not harder.
Yeah.
And this is a mindset shift of how you use your resources internally if you really want to dominate the internet. You know, I just did a workshop 2 days ago here in Dallas, and I was giving my audience insights in terms of how they can be better marketers. I call it being a savage marketer. And I had a couple of people rolling their eyes at me saying, well, this would never work for a company. Well, you know what? That's your choice, right? It's your choice if you want to advance your brand or not. The reality is that most companies out there today are seeing very poor engagement on social media. And there's a reason for that. And chances are because you're constantly selling to your audience and no one wants to be sold to. No one at all. Like, let me ask you, Steve, do you personally go on social media with the intent of looking for an advertisement?
No, of course not.
No, no one does.
Yeah. From time to time, there is an ad with something that I might be particularly interested in. Let's just say it's something musically related, a guitar related or something like that. And I'll see something, oh, there's a hack that I think I can use and I might buy it. So they know I'm interested in musical things. These are the kinds of sites I go to. So they are targeting me in some way.
Yeah, they target you because they most likely have what is referred to as tracking pixels on their website. So for example, you go to Amazon, you look at, you know, a pair of shoes, you don't buy the shoes, you go back over to Facebook, boom, you start seeing the shoes all over the internet, right?
Yeah.
That's an advertisement.
Right.
Eventually you might cave in and buy the shoes, right? But what I'm referring to is the average consumer is not going to social media with the intent of buying anything.
True.
And I think it's the first or second page of the book. I walk people through this natural progression. Like, think about a time where you saw an ad on Facebook and you whipped out your credit card on the spot and bought something. I know I've never done that.
Yeah.
And most people that I ask, they've never done that. But yet companies spend countless dollars on advertising when what they should be doing is take a step back and just listen and pay attention to what's being said and go have conversations with people. It's such a basic concept, but yet marketers have such a difficult time executing.
Hmm. So there's an opportunity for those that have this extra knowledge. You describe in your book that it's like a casino. You know that, you know, the house is going to win, but yet if you're specifically a poker player and you specialize in that, you have an advantage to beat other untrained or less aware poker players. So there is a way to win in this very complicated environment, even though generally speaking, you're an ocean of people doing the same things. It's very hard to stand out. But with specific skills, you possibly can win. My guest is Carlos Gil. His book is The End of Marketing, Humanizing Your Brand in the Age of Social Media and AI. We are not going to be able to delve down that much. But Carlos, I'm going to extend this interview for another few minutes. I want to discuss Facebook, because in your book, you mentioned that, you know, there's over 7 billion people in the world and over 2 billion of them are on Facebook. So Facebook is a power to be considered and actually probably in the future to be reckoned with. I don't want to get into conspiracy theories, but what is your take on the power of Facebook?
Facebook is without a doubt the most powerful company in the world, quite frankly, even more so I'd say than Google, because they have the ability to capture all this data on what we do and where we go and who we're friends with, and just power in that. But as I explained through the book, you can actually take that power back and leverage that data as well.
How?
Well, very simple, by getting to know your customers, right? So when you message me on my Facebook page, you get an autoresponder from me with my phone number, and then that phone number you text, and now I have your phone number. So now I don't need to market to you through Facebook. I can now market to you directly through your cell phone.
Uh-huh.
I'm cutting out the middleman. So I refer to social networks as being very similar to casinos because they are the house. You're never going to beat the house at their own rules.
Right.
So you're never going to beat Facebook and be smarter than Facebook. So just accept that. But what you can do is you can play by the rules and you can take data back. So you can ask customers for their phone number. You can ask customers for their email address, and you should be, there will come a day where it will become even harder to advertise and market on any of these social networks. And I feel 110% that the brands that right now are making the investment in humanizing their companies through people and also taking data back, meaning taking control back from the social networks, ultimately will win in the long run. Like, the name of the game is not to build a business just using social media. Social media is just a gateway. It's just an avenue. It's a medium.
Yeah. When someone says I'm online or I'm using social media, that's not really the strategy. That doesn't really tell you anything, does it?
No, absolutely not. Social media can be a big waste of time. Online marketing can be a big waste of time. It's a numbers game. You're trying to get in front of people. So I would rather get in front of people in mediums that are less clustered, like text message marketing, even email marketing. I think email marketing is going to make a huge comeback here in the next several years because there's less competition for people's attention. And you see, that's the commodity that we should all be chasing, is attention. And I think that that's been overlooked because, again, you have bad marketers that are focusing on metrics that really don't matter.
Interesting.
Such as likes.
Yeah, yeah. One statement you made in the book was that content is queen, but community is king. I was like, wow, that says a lot in one short sentence. Explain that to us.
Yeah, you know, what I mean by that statement is so many marketers, legacy marketers, you go to conferences and, you know, they all say the same rhetoric that content is king. And I really disagree with that. I think what content is noise. It's digital pollution. And if you're making noise, but yet no one's paying attention and no one really knows that you exist, then you're wasting your time. And, you know, I don't know about you, Steve, but I'm not in business to waste my time.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's just so much content going by. Let's take Facebook, flipping through the content when you get a moment and you get caught in this rabbit hole until you stop and you go, wait a minute. You know, I forgot my life here for 90 seconds or 5 minutes.
Right.
So there's a lot of content, but it's not really doing me any good. So this idea of community, which is harder. It's easy to create content these days. It's harder to create community. And maybe that's why that's what's going to work.
Yeah, it's difficult to build community because you can't buy a community. You can't really scale it. You can't run Facebook ads and all of a sudden you have a community. You have to work for it. You have to build relationships one by one. But here's the growth hack, right? If there is a growth hack that I can share with you, there's a community that already exists right now.
Yeah.
And you can tap into that community. You can go on Instagram. You can go on Twitter. You can have conversations with people. That's free.
Yeah.
And it doesn't require much effort or work.
Interesting. So it's right there in front of us, but it's the thing that really takes creativity and social skills. It is a social network, as opposed to creating content, you don't really have to talk to anybody.
Correct.
Yeah, got it. My guest, Carlos Gil, The End of Marketing, Humanizing Your Brand in the Age of Social Media and AI. Carlos, thank you so much for joining us and informing us all who own businesses or are trying to make some kind of mark in this world through our businesses on how to use this new technology. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, Steve.
Sure. Folks, as you know, my mission is always to educate my listeners. And I remind you week after week, segment after segment, that we love your questions because we truly do. Yeah, these are complicated times, which makes for more complicated topics like this one we just talked about with Carlos. And I am always here to answer your questions. If you have questions about your portfolio, your kids' kids, your retirement, your 401k, how to better take care of your family, anything financial on your mind, I'm here with over 35 years of experience, and I'd love to help you in any way I can. So go to our site, stevepomerantz.com, go to the contact section, let me know how we can help you. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update, which comes directly into your mailbox with all of the segments like this one that we produce every single week. That's stevepomerantz.com, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com, and contact us. Carlos, once again, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
You're listening to The Steve Pomeranz Show. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 31-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Always good to see you and have you in the studio. We want to talk about climate change and real estate because that's a hot topic if you think about it. You're in the real estate business, obviously.
Right.
And real estate is hard assets.
And we're the Sunshine State. And people come down here for the climate.
There was a recent study that took a look at real estate prices relative to climate change. And that's a big question in everybody's mind, especially here in South Florida, where there's so much land on the water.
Right.
And what they kind of discovered was not terribly surprising, but very interesting. Do you want to take it forward or should
I? Sure, sure. So basically, it all depends if you're a believer or a denier in the theory. So the way it is, if you're a denier of climate change, homes sell in those neighborhoods for 7% more.
On average. So let's talk about that. So if you think about it, you're in an area that is generally, doesn't believe that climate change is real for whatever reason. So there's nothing to worry about. So the prices are going to be higher because there's no discount for the concern of water intrusion.
That's right. Now, the other way around, if you're in a neighborhood area that's full of believers, well, that's going to drive the prices down. I mean, think about it. If the whole area got flooded, the prices would collapse. So it's that fear that drives those prices down.
Now, I mean, I've noticed in South Florida, I was looking for a place on the ocean some years ago, and I didn't buy because I was worried. You know, I know the science behind it, but I'm just a layperson, so I'm looking like right in front of me. I'm looking at the beach.
Beach erosion.
I'm looking at the water. I've been down in South Florida for a very long time, so I know where that beach used to be.
You just don't get a first floor unit, Steve.
Is that all it is?
Just go for a higher floor, you'll be good.
I don't think that's a solution, quite frankly. So I chose not to buy on the ocean, but I don't know that, in fact, you know what the story
is going
to be.
You're not alone.
Also, these effects from climate change are really long-term effects. They're not, according to this article, the homes, about $882 billion worth of homes, are at risk for being underwater by the year 2100.
Right.
I really can't think about what I'm doing next week.
Let alone 2100.
2100. But anyway, 10 to 12% of homes in Florida are kind of affected by that because we are obviously very high in beachfront property and the like.
Right.
Okay. Very good. So what are you seeing in your marketplace?
I do have people concerned about whether or not the property is in a flood zone.
Okay, that's a little different.
It's a little different.
Unless you live in Venice.
Right. Well, Venice, that's a different story. And that's not Venice, Florida. That's Venice, Italy.
Right.
And I understand the concern.
Okay, but it's
and
just
people
a concern.
Do ask. Yeah. So I do have some certain clients that will say, I don't want to live in a flood-prone zone. And we'll look at the flood maps.
Okay.
So we'll avoid those communities. And that's not steering.
I think it's just prudent.
It is.
I mean, since you don't know, and if water levels may rise, I mean, may not be happening now, but, you know, 5 years from now, it may be an issue. I think you'd really kind of want to know that.
Sure. No, and you should know whether or not you're in a flood zone and what the risk is.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Getting back to what we talk about a lot, like how is the real estate business?
Sure.
What's the story with prices, with sales? What does it look like these days?
Well, according to NAR, the National Association of Realtors, the existing home sales climbed about 1.9% in October.
That's sales, not prices.
That's sales. Well, if the number of sales are going up, there's also somewhat of a correlation to price. Prices are definitely still rising. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, the overall sales, it's up about 4.6%
year
over year.
That's year to
year. Right. Yeah. So we are seeing prices still rising.
Well, single family home prices are up 3.6%.
Right.
Year over year. And condo prices are up just under 6%. Year over year. This is in Florida. This is for the whole state of Florida.
Right.
So the trends are higher sales and higher prices still. And I guess the reason is that
lack of
rates,
inventory and very low interest rates.
Yeah. more demand,
right?
Lack of inventory still. Now, according to this document here, the fixed mortgage rates in October rose to 3.69%, still incredibly low,
right,
up from 3.61% in September. But versus 2018,
was it 4.54%?
So it's almost, let's call it 80 basis points, more than three quarters
of a percent
less.
Yeah, the interest rates are so attractive.
Yeah. And what's the rule? 1% move in interest?
10%.
10% in
price fluctuation. So if there's a 1% change in interest rate, you're looking at a $10,000 based on a median price home.
So let's take a $300,000 house.
Right.
10% is $30,000.
Right.
So interest rates go down by 1%, you can afford a $330,000 house.
Correct.
Okay. And vice versa.
And vice versa. Then you're
270.
Could be 270.
Okay. That's important. That's a good little rule of thumb.
Yep.
All right. There's also a new change. We don't have a lot of time here, but there's a change in listing practices by agents. And I want to go over this quick.
Okay. Real quick. It all has to do with posting the listing in the multiple listing service. So when an agent gets a listing, they're going to be required to put it in the MLS system as soon as they start marketing it to the public within 24 hours.
Okay. Why is that something special?
Well, why it's special is because agents have been holding back, putting it in the MLS, marketing it, trying to get their own buyer, if you will.
Well, how are they marketing it?
They can do it through Facebook, social media. They may use portals, different portals that they're able to get disseminate the information bypassing the MLS, which really isn't good for the whole real estate industry.
Yeah, because you're not seeing all the houses that are up there. And actually, the seller isn't really getting access to the complete population of buyers.
That's
right. But there are some sites which do specialize, let's say in the very high end, where perhaps a client's a famous person and they want to keep it private.
As long as they're not marketing, the key is marketing it to the public.
Mm-hmm.
So the listing's within a firm and they're just sharing that information between the agents within their office. That's going to be a little bit different scenario than marketing it to the public.
But no longer, well, there'll be a $5,000 penalty if an agent gets caught in listing off of the MLS. That's important.
Correct, correct.
Okay, my guest, as always, is Terry Story, a 31-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton. And she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Are you anxious about your financial future? Have you ever made money decisions you've regretted and then repeated the same mistake again? Or perhaps you avoid talking about money altogether? Life is unpredictable, but your decisions don't have to be. And knowing where you stand and having an ongoing action plan will help you get where you want to go. So when you understand that the cornerstone of success is in making good decisions coupled with deliberate action, you can start on the road to ensuring that you're investing the way you should and feel good that you're taking care of yourself and your family in the best possible way. And you know, this has been the mission of the Steve Pomerantz Show from the very beginning. So once again, I want to remind you that you can ask us anything on your mind financially by visiting stevepomerantz.com. And if you have more serious concerns or questions, I'll personally take the time to get back to you to help you find a solution. I've been helping people do just that for 35 years, helping them get ready for retirement, save for a house or college, and so many of life's turning points. So once again, go to stevepomerantz.com and click on Contact. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Investment advisory services are offered through United Capital Financial Advisors, a registered investment advisor. United Capital and the Steve Pomerantz Show are separate and unrelated companies.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. I thought that since we are approaching year end, it would be a very good time to take a look at tax moves that you can make right now to reduce your 2019 taxes. I mean, we're here in December, and we've only got a couple of weeks left So let's see what you can learn right now in order to save you some taxes next year. I have asked Rachel Sheedy to join me. Rachel is an editor for Kiplinger's Retirement Report, and she's written some articles on this in particular. So we're going to talk to her right now. Hey, welcome to the show, Rachel.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Sure. So before the new year arrives, as I said, it's time to take a look at some last-minute moves we can use to trim our taxes. First of all, between 2018 and 2019, are there a lot of changes or is it kind of business as usual?
There are not that many changes, which is a good thing. It makes it a little easier to look for tax-saving moves. You can refer back to your tax return for 2018 to kind of get an idea of where you might look to save some money for 2019. So yeah, it makes it a little easier, but it's pretty similar.
All right. Well, that's good. Everything changes so much these days.
Well, it did in recent years. Yeah. So
it's kind of a relief that everything's going to kind of be the same as last year. It's such a rare occurrence. All right. So your first tip is the easy stuff, you know, estimating your 2019 tax tab. By adding up all your taxable income streams. Now, people may laugh when I say all your taxable income streams. They go, well, you know, I got one, I got two, but some people have more.
Some people do, particularly retirees might have pension income, Social Security benefits, distributions from retirement accounts. Mm-hmm. Many retirees are surprised actually how much taxable income they end up with in retirement. So you do want to make sure you grab all of them in your calculation.
Yeah. So once you have a good idea of all of the revenue, so to speak, if you think of yourself as a company, mm-hmm. what revenue have I brought in? Now you have to kind of subtract and look at the tax breaks that you know you will use.
Exactly. Yeah. You kind of want to total those up, sort of see where you stand, things that you know that you might want to make use of. People who are 70 and a half and older can take advantage of the qualified charitable distribution move to sort of mitigate tax on their RMD money. So if you know you're going to use that, you want to account for that first and then sort of see where you stand and then start looking for other moves, see if you've got any other options to turn your tax down.
You want to see whether you're going to qualify for the standard deduction or are you going to use the standard deduction?
Yes, that is a key part of the calculation because the moves you make could be very different if you are taking a standard deduction or if you're going to be itemizing.
Yeah.
And you might also want to look over not just this year, but sort of consider this year, next year, maybe even 3 years down the line, because maybe you want to take the standard deduction this year, but you want to itemize next year. You might want to push some deductions year or another.
If you can, if you have the ability to delay deductions or accelerate them, you can make a decision as to what to do. Now, how much is for a single taxpayer and for married filing jointly, what are the amount of the deductions?
Well, for 2019, the standard deduction is $12,200 for single taxpayers. And $24,400 for taxpayers who are married and filing jointly.
Okay.
Of course, for people who are 65 or older, they can add an extra amount to that standard deduction. So for spouses, each spouse who's 65 or older can add an extra $1,300 to that standard deduction amount. And singles who are 65 plus can add $1,650. And there's also, you can add a standard deduction if you're blind as well. So that amount, those standard deduction amounts, that they doubled a couple years ago, they're pretty high these days.
So,
So many people aren't itemizing anymore or they're on the cusp. So again, as we mentioned, you know, if you accelerate or you push off deductions, you know, you might have enough to itemize them 1 year, but may not have enough to do it for 2 years.
Right.
So you can sort of, you know, really play with your tax strategy.
Yeah. So the standard deduction for couples is 24,400, which is double the 12,200.
Yeah.
And yet one spouse may not be making enough to qualify, but you're getting the benefit of it because it's filing jointly. So the other person perhaps can have more stuff they can kind of use it for.
Right.
So there's some kind of advantage. Now, you want to also avoid underpayment penalties. And this is important.
Yes.
Because you're required to pay estimated taxes. Most retired people do. And most self-employed people do, of course. Tell us about what you need to do to avoid paying penalties.
Yeah. So, and this is something I think some people got a shock for their 2018 returns because they didn't have enough withheld and things were sort of a little crazy. And the IRS gave people for 2018 a break. And experts are telling me do not expect that same break for 2019. So you really do need to make sure that you are double checking that you are paying enough in tax for 2019 before the year ends.
Now, if your tab is less than 1,000, you don't really have to worry about it.
Exactly. So that's a key number. And there's another way you can sort of avoid it is, you know, if you make sure that you paid at least 100%, or if you're a high income taxpayer, 110% of your 2018 tax bill, that will ensure that you don't have to worry about underpayment penalties. Or you can pay at least 90% of your 2019 tax tab. So you'll need to make sure your projections are pretty accurate. At this time of year, they will be more accurate than if you were looking at this in, you know, say, March or April.
I have a question. Hang on. So let's say that you pay 100% of what you paid in 2018.
Yes.
But you got some kind of a big bonus or something in 2019. Will that 100% cover you and help you avoid being penalized?
Yeah, if you paid at least 100% or 110% of your 2018 tax bill, you should be safe and you'll avoid the underpayment penalty.
Okay, good.
Yeah, if you haven't done that, then you need to pay some tax on that big lump sum that you're getting.
Yeah, so with the year end so close, your tax estimate for 2019 should be fairly accurate. I mean, you should really know by this point all the money that's coming in, so you can be more precise. So less room for error. All right, so let's talk about ways to trim this 2019 tax bill before the calendar flips to the next year. I'll start you off. The first thing you can do is, you know, do your 401k. Make sure that you do the full amount of your 401k. Take us through those machinations.
Yeah, so employer retirement accounts, those contributions have to be made by year end, so by December 31st. So that's 401ks and that type of account. And you can stash up to $19,000 into a 401k by the end of the year for 2019. But if you're 50 and older, if you turn 50 anytime this year, you can put in extra money. And for 401ks and employer plans, that's $6,000 extra for 2019.
Okay.
So that's $25,000 total that you could put away pre-tax for 2019.
All right. So that's important. Every dollar is a direct deduction from your adjusted gross income. And you're saving directly the taxes based on your tax bracket. There is really very little else people can do these days, right?
It is much harder. There is very limited options for trimming your tax tab.
Yeah, that's so true.
But you can, you know, there's IRAs if you qualify for deductible contributions. If you don't qualify for deductible contributions, you can still do non-deductible, or you might consider doing a Roth contribution, which will not help you right now, but it will help you in the future to save taxes.
Roths are wonderful. Mm-hmm. They're a wonderful way. I mean, if you don't need the tax deduction now, but you want to have your money grow tax-free and in the future date not have to pay when you withdraw it, it's a wonderful vehicle. The issue is that a lot of people with high incomes can never do a Roth IRA. But it is very valuable for those with moderate incomes, right?
Well, yeah, they can't do Roth contributions, but anybody with any income amount can do Roth conversion. If you don't qualify for the contribution, and again, this is a tax-trimming move for the future, not for today, because with Roth conversions, you do have to pay tax
on the amount
you convert.
Right, nothing is free.
But the benefits really in the future, and particularly for retirees who might be subject to Medicare premium surcharges or tax on their Social Security benefits, having that stash of, you know, tax-free income can be really key.
Can be very key. Yeah. There's another thing too, and that is the time value of money. Make your IRA contributions at the beginning of the year so you have a full year of tax deferral as opposed to making them at the end of the year, because a lot of people say, well, I'll just wait, I'll make it last minute, but you'd be smarter if you can make it in January, let's say for 2020,
right,
than December, because you've missed a whole year of tax deferred compounding.
Yeah, that's true. And I think some people put it off because IRAs, you can save money on your 2019 tax tab. I mean, if you can make deductible contributions, but you actually can, you know, put away that money as late as the mid-April tax filing deadline. Mm-hmm. So I think some people do wait
late
because of that delayed deadline. But you're correct that if you can put it in at the beginning of the year, you get that whole year of tax deferral.
It makes a big difference. And all you're doing is you're just taking money from one account. If you're taking savings and you're just moving it over to another account. So it's just a simple conversion or a transaction to move money from one to another, but you're getting significant benefits by doing that. Let's talk about health savings accounts very quickly.
Yeah.
You can contribute up to $3,500. Okay. So everybody kind of knows that if you work for an employer that has a health savings plan, you can make this up to $3,500 contribution. What if you're retired? Can you have an HSA?
Well, you have to have a high deductible health plan, whether it's through an employer or private insurance. Once you're on Medicare, you can no longer contribute to an HSA. There's some legislation in Congress that they're trying to change that, but who knows when that will happen. So once you're on Medicare, you need to not contribute anymore, but you can still use the money that's within the account. So if you're retired and you're pre-65, you might have an opportunity to still save in a health savings account mm-hmm. if you choose a high deductible health plan. And it's great if you have the opportunity to build up that account. Again, you'll save money on taxes now if you contribute to that health savings account, but you can also save money on taxes in the future with that stash. So it is definitely something to look at as an opportunity.
Yeah, it's the one vehicle where you kind of do get the benefit of both, because you're getting the deduction when you fund the HSA.
Mm-hmm.
And when you spend the money, if you use it for the appropriate medical purposes, you don't have to pay taxes on it. So it's really a very attractive thing that you can do. I want to switch gears here, because for those that are over 70 and a half that, you know, don't qualify for other deductions but are charitably inclined, there is something pretty important that you can do. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so it's the Qualified Charitable Distribution Move, QCD, what it's sort of commonly known as. And it's a move that had been around for a number of years, but it wasn't made permanent until just a couple years ago. So you have to be 70 and a half or older. You have to be qualified to take required minimum distributions.
Yeah.
But if you meet that age requirement, you can directly transfer from your IRA to charity up to $100,000.
Yeah.
And that money that you transfer to charity can count toward your RMD, and that money will not show up in your adjusted gross income. So it's great for people who are no longer itemizing and, you know, charitably inclined. They can still essentially get a tax break for giving money to charity by doing the qualified charitable distribution move. But it's also actually good for itemizers too. So if you are still one of those people itemizing, because the QCD does not show up in your AGI, any tax break that's based off thresholds that are, you know, tied to AGI, you might qualify for because your AGI is lower by doing the QCD. So it's something to look at no matter how you know, if you do standard deductions or itemize, take a look at it if you qualify.
And for all intents and purposes, with the elimination of a lot of the itemizing, people really can't get a deduction on their charitable contributions anymore.
Yeah, it's really hard. You know, if you no longer have, say, mortgage interest, which is a big tax deduction for many people, you would have to make a lot of charitable deductions to surpass the standard deduction amount. So this qualified charitable distribution move allows you to, you know, still sort of get a tax break and give to charity at the same time, which, you know, a good thing. Most people want to try to do that.
Yeah. So if you're charitably inclined, there's no question that this QCD is a very, very good idea.
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk about some of the kind of the tried and true methods. First of all, harvesting your losses.
Yes.
You know, a lot of people have losses in their portfolio. I mean, it's inevitable if you have, you know, a diversified portfolio.
Right.
That you're going to have some losses. But a lot of people like to hang on to their losses and sell their gains, which is kind of the opposite of what you should be doing.
Sure. Yes, exactly.
You know, it's like cutting your good flowers in the garden and, you know, letting the weeds grow. You know, it doesn't make any sense.
I think some people are optimistic and think.
And they're optimistic. Yeah, exactly. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That sucker's coming back. I know it.
Right. Exactly.
Right. But a loss has value. That's kind of an asset.
Yes.
In a sense, because that amount of the loss can be used as a qualified or verifiable deduction. And you can save taxes on it. And then 31 days later, you can buy it back. So your only risk is that you're out of that thing for 30 days or 31 days.
Yeah, you do need to watch for that wash sale rule, as it's called.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I think a lot of people, you know, the stock market has been going gangbusters for a number of years at this point. So some people might not think to look for losses. But it's true. If you're with a diversified portfolio, not everything goes up when the market goes up. So it's definitely something to scour your portfolio for it. And see if you can take advantage of those losers.
Well, that's how you know your portfolio is diversified.
Mm-hmm.
If everything is going up together, guess what, guys? You are not diversified.
That's a good point.
You need some things yinging and yanging so you can look at your portfolio and, you know, kind of in a very surface way, determine whether you've got some diversification here. But you're right. With the market being up so much as we air this show anyway, because you never know what's going to happen. Then, you know, most investors really have pretty significant gains this year. But if you look closely, you will, in fact, find some losses. I'm sure of it. My guest, Rachel Sheedy from Kiplinger's Retirement Report. And today we were discussing year-end moves that you can make for your 2019 taxes, looking a little bit ahead to 2020, looking at some charitable things that you can do. And thank you so much for joining us, Rachel.
Thank you for having me.
And remember, everybody, that we love to educate our listeners, and we continue to remind you that we love to get your questions because we really do. So come to our website at stevepomerantz.com, go to the contact section and write us a question. If you have any, we will answer that question. We make every effort to do so. And also, while you're there, you can sign up for our weekly update, where you can get right into your mailbox every single week what we call the WOO, the weekly update, which gives you every single segment, transcripts if you'd rather read than listen, a summary if you just want a quick idea of what's going on, and then, of course, a way to contact us with your questions. Go to stevepomerantz.com, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z. Skip the T, go right to the Z, stevepomerantz.com, and we would love to hear from you. www.stevepomerantz.com. I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Malzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.